It's Sam Cedar launching an illegal invasion and occupation of your brain.
This episode of the Majority Report is brought to you by Audible.com. You can get a free audiobook of your choice. Go to audiblepodcast.com/majority report. That's audiblepodcast.com/majority report for a free audiobook.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar, where every day's casual Friday. That means Monday is casual Monday. Tuesday, casual Tuesday. Wednesday, casual hump day. Thursday, casual Thurs. That's what we call it. And Friday, casual Shabbat. The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
It is Friday, July 6, 2012. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. It's Casual Friday. That means Cliff Schechter returning from his vacation of jet skiing. I find out, did he go to the Bermudas or the... Not the Bermudas. I guess Bermuda is what they're calling it now. The Cayman Islands. Was he in Switzerland? Was he jet skiing in Lucerne? We'll find out in a moment. Also on the program today, yes, the former conservative wonder kid, now not a conservative, and entering manhood, Jonathan Crone will be here to give us movie recommendations for the weekend. That should be rather interesting. Also on the program today, New York Police Department putting out wanted posters for people who complain about the police. A new offer from Iran. Con Ed locks out its workers. And the Presbyterians vote against divestiture in companies doing business in the occupied territories in Israel. And, of course, Rush Limbaugh still has a problem with women. And the wonderful, heartwarming story of a Republican legislator in Louisiana who accidentally voted to impose Sharia law on all of us. That's a broad generalization, but we will talk about that in the program. We will get to Cliff Schechter in just a moment.
Every day I get up and pray to John. And he increases the number of clocks by exactly one. Everybody's coming home for lunch these days.
This episode of the Majority Report is brought to you by Audible.com, the internet's leading provider of audiobooks with more than 100,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature, featuring audio versions of many New York Times bestsellers. You can get a free audiobook download now if you go to audiblepodcast.com/majority report. Why not pick up Paul Krugman's End This Depression Now? You can get it for free at audiblepodcast.com/majority report. That's audiblepodcast.com/majority report. Pick up that Paul Krugman or any other book now.
Some people say that bowling alley's got big lanes.
Got big lanes. Got big lanes.
Some people say that bowling alley's...
Cliff Schechter, Libertas LLC, New Media, Public Relations, and Strategy. You want any of these services, you know who you gotta see. Cliff
Shakta, Libertas LLC.
Oh, yes, the wonderful Jimmy Reefer Cake theme song announcing to the world that Cliff Schechter is joining us on a casual Friday. Hello, Cliff.
Sam, how are you, buddy?
I'm doing all right. Crappy jobs numbers out today. And
yeah, 80,000, huh?
80,000, and the unemployment rate remains unchanged. This was less than the projected 100 to 150,000. I was on Viewpoint last night with Money Morning Ben. Is that his name from Politico? Is that it? Morning?
Something like that, yeah.
And at the end of the segment, we were talking about Romney, and he asked, Spitzer wanted to know our employment number guesses, which I never do because I generally have no clue. But I said under 100,000, the professional who speaks to the financial people said between 100 and 150. And Elliot Spitzer was up at around 175. And my
feeling, I guess what you're trying to say is you're smarter than they are. Is that
no, it's just that, you know, the bottom line is, There has been no reason to believe that things are going to get any better than they are. We're barely at parity because obviously you need 100,000, 120,000, I think, to maintain the employment levels. That number obviously decreases because our population is aging a little bit. But there has been no activity. There's been nothing to promote jobs growth in any fashion, and there's no reason to expect that it's going to happen.
I've read that, some things about the housing market getting a little bit better, which I think was sort of inevitable when you think about how low interest rates were and that prices have been so far off. You know, they kind of, some of those foreclosed homes had to get cycled out of the market, which I know, being someone who was trying to sell a house a little while back. But you know, those are like little things right now. It seems like, you know, oh, yeah, things are getting slightly better. They're around the margins. I'm not an economist. I'm not going to pretend to be one. But, yeah, I do have some common sense and some ability to read now and again. You know, it's the same old story. We've talked about this a lot in terms of economic stimulus and the rest. I mean, what's going on in the States has so dampened everything, because so many workers, state workers, have lost their jobs that it just is, I mean, it becomes a downward spiral.
We lost another 4,000 government workers this past month. And, you know, I mean, to be fair, the President Obama did put up a jobs bill in last fall. And it called for, I think it was around $50 billion, is off the top of my head, $50 billion basically sending money to the states and municipalities. Supposedly, of course, it would have created up to 1.5 million jobs in 2012 alone, maybe 1.9. It depends on whose numbers you used. But there was no chance of that passing anyways. I mean,
I'm glad he did it. Obviously the problem is it's always this sort of the arrogance of not doing it when you have the ability to do it.
Indeed. And, you know, that's what it comes down to. And, you know, I want to talk, I want to spend some time, crapping on Mitt Romney because there was some stories.
We have to talk about him just because he's awesome. And I just spent like my whole column this week trying to come up with ways he could do things to make him more out of touch. Because every time he does something, every time I think he's done like the dumbest thing, he's just amazing.
It really is. It really is stunning. I mean, you know, when I'm around sort of mainstream pundits, there's always this, well, you know, I mean, Nate Silver has, I think, you know, on his 538 blog on the New York Times, 68% chance that Obama is going to get reelected, which seems to me to be a pretty high percentage. I would not want to be on the other end of that. But, none of the mainstream pundits that I will talk to will admit the obvious. It's just that Mitt Romney is a horrible candidate. He is a horrible, horrible candidate.
Mean,
but wait, before we get there,
I'm so tempted, but go ahead.
Yes, it's pretty low hanging fruit, and it's sort of fun for a Friday. But this week I had Bill Scherer on the program, who has been a longtime friend of the show. I think he's probably one of the first people I ever interviewed, even in our practice sessions back in 2004 before Air America launched. And but, you know, Bill and I have a pretty strong disagreement on our analysis of the Obama administration. And while, you know, we'll probably end up voting for the same person, more or less, for the sake of argument, let's say, in the fall. I mean, I'm in New York and et cetera, et cetera. I don't want to go through all those sort of qualifications again. But I don't know if you saw his piece in the New York Times Sunday. And his argument is that the way that liberals win, the way that we see any type of liberals reform, is to make sure that we have a corporate buy-in at the as early in the process as possible. And while I think there's some reality, there's some truth to that, the fact is that you can still make a very bad deal in that situation. He cited FDR, one of his programs in his first 100 days, and getting a buy-in from corporate America by suspending antitrust laws in return for better working conditions for people. And my point was that it's one thing to suspend antitrust laws. It's another, in the case of, let's say, healthcare, to build essentially a permanent bailout for an industry that serves no social utility.
Right. Well, and that's I think that's exactly. I would agree with you. That's not going to shock you here. Or anybody listening who's listened in the past. But, I mean, not only is that an important part of it, but there's a number of differences from, you know, and I read Bill's piece and I debated a little bit with him on a listserv we're on and whatever. And I think he's a great guy, so there's no criticism meant of him, too. I consider him a good friend. But you know, it's who the deal is made with, who's coming from a position of strength. FDR was coming from a position of strength. I mean, you just can't compare in the weak rhetoric and the people that Obama chose to put in his administration versus who FDR chose to put in his administration, and the stance that he took. Yeah, I think that getting corporate buy-in and getting them to agree with you is a good thing. But coming at them from, I mean, you know, they were scared but with the way FDR was talking, and you know, when he was elected in 1932, and with the kind of Congress he had. You know, they were scared of that. We actually were not the kind of tepid, fake socialism that the right accuses the left of today. They actually were scared we were headed towards socialism back then, and we could have been. So, you know, FDR stood up strongly. The best example I can think of, you know, when it came to people, as opposed to appeasing the people that stood up to him, you know, is the court packing incident, which some people said, oh, it was a big failure or whatever. But notice how the courts did exactly what he wanted after that.
Yes,
they stopped finding things unconstitutional once he threatened them.
Indeed. And I've always been mystified at the perception that somehow was a failure. I mean, maybe I just don't know the history well enough, but my perception has always been that it's not. I mean, we had Darren Acemoglu on the program, and I can't believe I just pronounced his name correctly because I didn't.
I'm impressed by that, by the way.
I wasn't able to do that at the time. And he wrote a book about the implications of societies failing when they didn't have inclusive institutions. And he cited that particularly as a bad episode. And I was like, well, wait a second. It seems to me FDR did was to force the court to move in a more inclusive direction. In other words, saying what is best for the country in terms of all the people, not a specific group of them. And, you know, I think the problem that I had with Bill's whole thing, I understand that he and I have a different perspective on the value of President Obama's presidency, but it doesn't take into account the context in which Obama came in.
That's the problem. You have to take, and I'll let you continue. I'm not trying to cut you off, but
no,
the overall context of what FDR was. did and what he was facing. I hate saying this because I like Bill, and this sounds kind of condescending and obnoxious, but I just think it's a very facile analysis. It's comparing two things and very superficial things. Yes, they both worked with business, but how did they work with business? How did business and obstructionist judges and legislators come to the table because of the stances FDR took? Can you ever imagine Obama standing up and saying, I invite these guys to hate me, and I enjoy it? It's also who you work with in business. For example, I sat here scratching my head the entire time, during the healthcare process, and I think I was, a little less cynical than I am about the whole thing now. But saying there actually was a big natural business market to work with strategically in that. It was big businesses that some of whom we had bailed out who were being killed by healthcare costs. Who as part, first of all, as part of the bailouts, the government had a lot of power over these guys. And, we knew that guys like GM were getting killed because each car is getting $1,500 added onto it because of health care costs, because health care is so out of control. Don't you think there are a lot of big businesses from potentially Wall Street banks on this issue that would have been willing to work potentially with Obama? Because the truth is that getting rid of their health care costs would have made them much more competitive and been better for them.
Indeed.
Why would you go to the industry you're regulating and work with them as opposed to the other big corporate entities that stand to benefit from that industry being regulated? Not to mention all the small businesses out there, and as somebody who, has started two of them and is involved in the third one in the radio station in D.C., I can tell you, having looked at healthcare costs and dealt with it as a small businessman, they're constraining, they're destructive. This whole orgasm the right has collectively over the entrepreneurial spirit and whatever is all BS, because if they really believe in any of that, they realize that one of the biggest things that kills their entrepreneurial spirit is the fact that you can't hire people because the healthcare costs are insane.
Yep.
And had you taken that load away from small business, off of small business, by providing more government-run healthcare, that would have spurred business in a huge way. If I'd have to worry about that, I'd be much more willing to hire people. I'll tell you that right now.
But in a broader sense, I think it's hard to sort of assess our situation in this country and not feel that one of the burning problems is the corporatization of the country, is the problem that we have, that we are diminishing the power of labor in this country. We've been doing it progressively for the past 30 or 40 years. We can see it in terms of stagnating wages versus corporate profits. We can see it in many different areas.
CEO versus worker pay.
Versus worker pay. I mean, by any measure, there really is, by any measure that you want to look at, any metric, that is the one of the primary problems that we have in this country, that too few are getting the benefits of society now. And there is nothing in what President Obama has done that has even addressed that, never mind even kicking the can down the road. I mean, look, Chris Hayes used that.
Go ahead, sorry.
Well, Chris Hayes used that example of the dilemma with healthcare was analogous to paying protection money to the mafia. You can either try and drive them out of your neighborhood in this bloody war, which you may lose, or you can pay them off and make sure that your business is intact and that the neighborhood is safe and whatnot. But you still have this monster, the mafia out there, who could come in any day and say, you know what, we're going to decide we're going to take a little bit more from you. And the failure of the Obama administration at the end of the day, in my assessment, is that even if you believe this notion that you have to have corporate buy-in, the value of that deal has to be judged based upon whether or not there is any type of road or plan or long-term reason to believe that you have diminished corporate power relative to labor, or however you want to define the rest of us. And there's
right.
None of that. It goes the other way. And so, we could still have an insufficient healthcare reform, but one which in some fashion at least provide some plan or mechanism for down the road for diminishing corporate power, and there's none of that. None of that.
Right.
And that's, to me, what the public option was all about.
And what FDR did, of course, exactly empowered. It's not to say that he didn't make certain deals and didn't work with labor, and again, I mean, work with some corporations, and again, there were corporate actors on this particular issue of healthcare that could have been worked with.
Right.
You know what I mean? Even if you couldn't work with them, let's say on Wall Street reform, you may have different allies in different situations. But there were a whole bunch of people that have interest in not having their healthcare costs be through the roof and be hamstringing them when it comes to competitiveness because of so many countries that have enacted universal healthcare and companies don't have that cost on their balance sheet. And it seems like instead of going to those guys first, you know, I wasn't behind closed doors, but at least it seems from the outside. So going to those guys first, we went to the guys who were going to regulate and begged them from a position of weakness. Second of all, it's not accepting the reality that corporations are in a situation today where they weren't in back then, where they have television, where they can mass broadcast propaganda in a way they were simply unable to do back then.
Right.
And so not weakening that, not hamstringing – I mean, look at the way Citizens United eventually turned out and what that's done in terms of corporate power, and to say, well, you know, you can make deals with them. Well, there's something that needs to be stopped there because their money can do a lot more damage. And then you also had on top of that the sort of countervailing force to that, which is this enormous email list because of other technology that didn't exist during FDR's time, and yet that was never used. The 13 million people, if you're going to create that list and put that together, and they all had buy-in, and everyone was excited for change and ready to do it, and then there was no ask of them to try and do this. To tell them what an important mission it was. So there's just there's all that, and I would even, you know, I'll go a step further and say, at least in terms of how corporations are acting, you know, behaving, there's some maybe comparison from today to back in FDR's time. But when Bell brought in LBJ, there's no comparison whatsoever, because during that time, that was in still what I would call what historians call a liberal consensus period of time, when the New Deal ruled and where everything was moving to the left, when Richard Nixon felt compelled to offer a health care bill that was to the left of Obama's, and
right.
Where Obama's ended up being a pretty similar one, a different period in time when the sort of public good ethic is what ruled, and it wasn't just about shareholders, corporations, you know, even if they didn't believe it privately, publicly at that time, it was believed that corporations actually had a responsibility to the public.
Right.
So you know, that it was a different time. LBJ was more able to work with some of those guys because a lot of those guys weren't the same. You know, the Chamber of Commerce after the Powell, the famous Powell memo, Judge Powell. We've talked about this on your show before. They went from being a mainstream pro business organization to be a bunch of teabagging global warming denying nuts, and they've pushed a lot of corporations in that direction. You know, they've extorted a lot of these guys, and, you know, so have Republican leaders like Mitch McConnell, you know, who I wrote a piece on a number of years ago for the Washington Monthly, who essentially threatened the guy, you know, corporations that favored campaign finance reform and saying that he wouldn't do it. I mean, it's just a different period of time, and you have to take all that into account, and that's why you really can't do it in an op-ed.
Right.
You know what I mean? So that's my problem with all. It's just too simple an analysis. And it's not to say Obama wasn't going to face serious challenges. But, A, I've discussed, I guess, ad nauseum at this point, there were alliances he could have made that he didn't try to make, or at least he didn't appear to try to make in the corporate world. B, there were factors he had to deal with to stop corporate propaganda and to stand up to it that FDR didn't have to worry about because of TV and whatever. But there were also, you know, troops in that army on his email list that FDR didn't have access to do that. You know, and so there are different things going on. I mean, we're in a much more of a corporate grip today, you know, in a dangerous way. You know, and I don't know.
The divide and conquer strategy is a good. I mean, you know, what was it, the swipe card fees battle that we saw was sort of like a classic battle of two massive industries essentially fighting it out. And I think your point is well taken that the divide and conquer strategy is a good one, but you have to make sure that you're dividing the right players.
That's right.
And he didn't necessarily pit the the right industries against each other as a way of getting to that point. But
whenever you make a deal, let me talk also. Go first in a position of weakness to the guys that are going to be on the losing end of that deal.
Right.
But again, that's kind of like what he did with the Republicans. Similarly,
yep.
He went to the people that were on the losing end, who were literally crushed in 2006 and 2008, demolished, had been written off at that point. We're a massive minority party. The Democrats almost having a supermajority in the Senate, at one point even achieving that, and you know, and have big congressional majority and the rest. And you go to those guys from a position of weakness and say, please, as opposed to going from a position of strength and saying, yeah, I want you along, kind of like what we talked about with the stimulus and other stuff. I want you along, Olympia Snow and Arlen Specter, whatever, but you're going to come along. And yeah, I'll make some compromises to give you some carrots as well as some sticks, but don't think you're not going to get the stick. Because if you don't come along, I'm going to go to your state where I just won the election, and I'm more popular than you, and I'm going to blame the mess on you.
And the other thing that I think bothered me about it, poor Bill. But we certainly had, we certainly
let's
went
say again
over
if
this.
Bill's listening. I love you, Bill. I just disagree with you on that.
Was the idea that it was how liberals win? It really undersells what winning is. You know, I mean, I think, you know, like if the op-ed had been titled like liberals can never really win, you know, then I could accept on some level, you know, a piece that says, look, the reality is that we don't have that we have a very weak hand at this time in history, which I think certainly arguable. I think our hand would have been much stronger in 2008 if it had been played in a different way. But he could have said, the reality is we don't have a very strong hand. And so we can, you know, in praise of incrementalism, which at least would have been, in my estimation, a more sort of reality-based type of perspective, rather than sort of there is a quality here of we should be celebrating these tiny victories as opposed to sort of being resigned to this is the way that change happens. And
right. And the last thing I think it's important is and I know a lot of people on lists I'm on had a problem with, is in the first sentence when he refers to Obama as a progressive, which again, if you want to call him, you know, I'd say calling Obama center left is stretching it, and centrist would have been fair in saying, you know, he's a good government centrist who is on our side in a lot of things, although he's not in others. And I think that would have been a fair statement to make, because it's not, again, I've given Obama credit. I think, you know, I think Sonia Sotomayor is a fantastic pick overall. I like his Supreme Court picks. You know, I like a number of the things he's done, what he did with the auto bailout. And I mean, it's not to say that there haven't been some good progressive things coming out for gay marriage, even though it was too late. It was still something that was important. And so, again, it's not to say that overall, I'm not going to sit here and say, like some people do, oh, he's a right winger. I don't think he is. But I do think centrist is a pretty kind of honest description of what he is, and to say, you know, to call him a progressive up front, I think you lose a lot of credibility in that piece.
And
you know?
And frankly, you diminish what it means to be a progressive or what it means to be a liberal. I mean, this is the you know, one of the biggest concerns that I've had with Obama for a long time, is that it's one thing to say this is the best that we can do at this point. And, you know, you look back on that campaign and our choices were fairly limited in terms of there was no big there was no, you know, John Edwards was the closest that we had come. And, you know, arguably that would have turned into at least a political disaster. But the point is that you're also hurting the brand of what it means to be a liberal or progressive. And, you know, I don't know. I mean, that's maybe we've talked enough about that and we can go.
Yeah, and you know, we have. It's a Friday. Let's have some fun and make fun of Mitt Romney.
Oh, my God, this guy.
I mean, do you know right now that first of all, the tropical heat here
in Ohio.
It's so tropical here that I heard that Mitt Romney is looking at hiding some of his money in banks here. Sorry, I had to try that one out.
Yes, I like it. That's good. You know, I don't understand. You know, last night, like I say, I was on with Morning Money Ben and Elliot Spitzer. And, you know, we can talk about whether or not he's evading taxes or avoiding taxes, evading being illegal, avoiding being not illegal. I think at this point there's a legitimate reason to say there's reason to believe he was evading taxes, because if he wasn't, he would certainly be releasing these tax forms. I mean, he is, you know, all of these shell games are so obscure that it almost stretches the imagination to believe that he's not hiding things that right. would be worse than what he's showing. I mean, this is the
is
stuff.
He so money. I mean, like,
well, then the other point is he's greedy. He's greedy. He's greedy beyond belief.
Does he lack such self-awareness, or is he that freaking greedy?
He's not.
You're worth $250 million. What if you gave up $25 million of those dollars in non-Swiss bank accounts and Grand Caymans and whatever? Because for whatever reason, which I don't get, because if I had his life, I would, you know, I wouldn't have wanted to get there the way he got there. But if I had his money, I would just enjoy my golden years. You can bet your butt about that. But the fact is, he obviously is obsessed, much like the last two Republican presidential candidates, with outdoing his dad. Because right. there's daddy issues always in the Republican Party for some reason. And so he has to be president, even though I can't see a justification for it, again, when you have the lifestyle he has. So if you know you're going to run for president, if you know, let's say, you need to appeal to people that have less money than the Gates family, then wouldn't you say to yourself, this is going to look terrible and I should just pay a little bit more because we've got so much money, we're swimming in it anyhow? And this is gonna obviously come out. I mean, would you? I mean, again, the self-awareness.
Well, that's the cynical view, right? I mean, like, I've got to, and presumably, it's quite possible that they looked at their finances and they said, "Ooh, this looks really bad," and if we move it to this. Where, you know, you can see records, you can see that we had these Swiss bank accounts, you can see that we had the Cayman Island accounts and the Bermuda accounts and the what is it? He's got $100 million in his IRA?
Yeah. Yeah, 101, 102, something.
How the F does that happen?
How do you legally get that in? I mean, I know what the limits are in IRAs. How do you do that?
And supposedly the way he did it is that Bain had this thing where they would have two types of shares. One was very undervalued shares only for them, and then shares for the rest of the stooges. And their very undervalued shares would just explode once they got into that tax-free account.
Is that the rest of us don't have access to that stuff.
Look, isn't the theory that people go and serve as a president, that get that serve in public service because they have presumably some measure of patriotism beyond the average guy who's just out for himself? But yet everything this guy has done, I mean, I'm sorry, like, I, you know, there is no doubt in my mind that out of just sort of maybe some combination of laziness and just sort of some vague sense of civic duty that I probably overpay my taxes. Because I don't want to just, like, you know,
I don't
want to deal with having to find every receipt that I had for a contribution here or there or whatever it is. And I don't know. I really don't know. I mean, I'm horrible with anything that has to do with personal finances. And I just sort of feel like, you know what, fundamentally, I feel like I'm paying taxes. I've been very fortunate in my life, and there's, you know, there's no reason for me to be nitpicky about this, to save a grand here or something.
Meanwhile,
like that.
Admit if he had that one receipt for like $12.27, the bottom of like an enormous lawnmower,
he's going beyond.
He would dive through.
He's
to try
going
to get
beyond
it.
That. He's setting up accounts in every which part of the far-flung universe to avoid paying what appears to be a 15% tax that the guy pays.
Right, and it's every single place that like, I mean, it's like the rogues gallery, the hit list of literally, it's not like it's initially the Switzerland thing came out, but it's every single place that you go and you put your money if you don't want to pay taxes.
It should like be a ride at Disney World. Every tax haven that you could possibly go on, you just sort of go through.
You're doing the Mitt Romney tour.
Exactly. They're playing. It's a small world, or it's a small marginal tax rate world, and
it's a carried interest loophole world.
You're just floating through, and there's Dubai, and there's the Caymans, and there's Switzerland, and
if there was literally a lockbox on Uranus where you could get a tax write-off of 15% for putting your money there, that's where Mitt's money would be right
indeed.
Now.
Indeed. And so, you know,
I meant the planet, by the way.
The idea that this guy, who's so greedy, just so greedy to keep his money out of the government's coffers. You know, but what is the point? But here's the thing.
It's hysterical. Like, I mean,
how do you get from there? How do you get from there to wanting to dedicate yourself to public service? It just doesn't work.
That's what I mean. You know that he's driven to do it by who his family was.
Right.
You can tell that, and sort of the way he interacts and the awkwardness. He's not a natural politician. He's terrible, and he doesn't do it because he enjoys being around people. You know, whatever you want to say, and maybe a little too much for that matter, Bill Clinton enjoyed being around people. You know what I mean? I mean, and frankly, George W. Bush to a certain degree, too, an old back-slapping fraternity guy, liked people. You know, this guy doesn't like being around people. He's doing it because he feels some sense of he must do it, you know, and must force himself to go in front of audiences and speak and try to shake hands with people like humanoids do, you know, when
and
he meets them.
Let's go one further. Let's go one even further step. What is, if you could look back on Mitt Romney's career and say, what is the ideological perspective that drives him? Is there anybody in America who could sum that up? I mean, I may not agree.
You could sum it up in one word. You could sum it up, Mitt. It's him. I mean, he's his own ideology.
I mean, I may not like what President Obama's ideology is or his specific apps. I mean, I'm using ideology with a small I. I think Obama's driven by some notion that he could bring people together and he can bridge a divide and he can do the responsible thing and whatnot. And, you know, he is in some respects specifically non-ideological, but you can divine from his public life and his writings what he perceives as his mission. Is there anybody in America who could say what Mitt Romney's mission is? What drives Mitt Romney? I think you're right. It's Mitt Romney.
Has to be the greatest. He doesn't feel worthy, so he has to be the richest. That means saving every dollar. That means having the biggest house. That seems to be it. You know, I mean, remember he went to the guy who owns Papa John's Pizza, you know, and made that comment that went on YouTube where he's like, you know, Republicans believe, Democrats don't believe anybody should have this. Republicans believe everybody should live like this.
Mm-hmm.
And it was sort of like, though, to some value of this guy was his house, was his beautiful house. And because that's what some value of somebody is, your house and how powerful you are. And I mean, he's one of those guys. I mean, again, with the point I want to get across is the lack of self-awareness, you know, with all these foreign investments and all this other stuff, which immediately is going to be terrible. It's bad enough if you're just trying to avoid taxes when you're going to foreign markets, to foreigners to try to do it. But beyond that, who in their right mind during a presidential time when you know you're going to be running for president says, you know, I've got a 3,000, 3,500 square foot house on a private beach in San Diego. I'm going to hire a lobbyist to go talk to town officials to change zoning laws so I can add 8,000 square feet in a car elevator to that. I mean, who the hell does that? Like, can you, I mean, you know, you couldn't wait until after you got elected president. You couldn't wait 2 years. I mean, the only conclusion I can come to is he's such a greedy bastard. He doesn't even know he has no clue how that looks.
I think that's right. I think that's right. I mean, you know, you would think last night was the first time in the lead up in that segment last night, that was the first time I saw the pictures of him jet skiing. And I just thought, like, you know, I remember when the pictures of John Kerry sailboating or whatever, parasailing.
Yeah, windsurfing.
Windsurfing.
Which was, again, I mean, whatever, we may like Kerry's beliefs.
And I just thought, like, you got to be effing kidding me. I mean, I sat there in 2004. I sat there and I was like, you know, I had turned down a that was just as I was transitioning, not necessarily conscious of it, but out of the entertainment world. And I got an offer to do a movie in October of 2004. And I told my agent, I said, I can't possibly do this. This is, you know, I've been on the radio for 4 or 5 months, and I've been telling people that I believe this is the most important election that I've ever been a part of. And I can't possibly go and do an effing movie, you know, 3 or 4 weeks before the election. I can't do it. I can't take the time off. And then to watch... Then to have seen John Kerry, you know, windsurfing, is like, you know what, dude?
I should have done
just
a movie.
Put it off. Just put it off for 6 months. I don't care. You know, if you really need to find some time, go in your basement, get a Wii, and just pretend
right.
you're
it's
on the windsurf.
It's amazing. And Romney, it almost seems like, because, you know, he had all the boys sitting around the, you know, doing their thing. It almost seems like it's some, like, he's trying to get, like, some Kennedy-esque type picture of, look, we're the vibrant, young, good-looking family. And he doesn't get that's not exactly, when you're on your jet ski, that's exactly not the way it's coming off. It's coming off like you're a rich asshole sitting there on a jet ski while other people are looking for a job in 110-degree weather in cities all over the country. And it's, I mean, again, it's just, it's mind-boggling when I saw that. I mean, I started trying to make a list of things, and I'm like, what can this guy do to be more out of touch than I mean, you know, I think he hasn't yet played polo while riding on the backs of homeless people. I think that's one he might want to think about trying.
I was just thinking, he could take a trip to the Caymans and just sort of step outside of like whatever that building is that has all the addresses of all the corporations down there and just hold a check with a big smile.
Yeah, the big check of money coming out of his pockets, take a picture. Here's another one I think I came up with. I think he should add a big giant mechanical mouth to his house and just let it go and eat all the poorer houses in the neighborhood next to him. That's another idea. I'm just trying. I don't know, man. I mean, you got to experiment to try to come up with stuff crazier than the stuff this guy already has come up with to make himself look like he has nothing in common with anybody else.
It's pretty impressive to watch now all of these right-wing outlets begin to jump ship. They're all racing to be the first or second in line, saying that Romney's blowing it. As a way of maintaining their credibility. And you're going to see, I mean, it's what it's going to do is it's also going to
they could have nominated at this time. I mean, there's just no doubt about that. Yep. In terms of the persona and the whole thing, it's, you know, it was bad enough to nominate a guy like, frankly, like John Kerry, who gives that off that image anytime.
Right.
You hurt yourself. But during this particular time, in an election, they should have a great shot at winning. I really do. The more I just see him out there, I think Obama will win, only because of that. And they seem to be ignoring the advice of all the wise and geniuses in Washington, you know, who were off on the hot, you know, July 4th weekend in their houses on, you know, on the shore in Maryland and places like that. Don't attack Bain. Well, you know what? Out here in places like where I am, it's working, and it's working for a reason. It's not because people are unfair and because they envy him, which, you know, Republicans would say whatever. It's because when you watch a guy who's paying 13.9% in taxes and you're paying twice as much or three times whatever, and he's not only is he doing that, that's too much for him. So he's putting money in Swiss bank accounts and the rest of them, and he's jet skiing in your face, and he made his money off of sending your job to China. It just all adds up to something that's so utterly obnoxious right now.
Right.
That it's really not about who's wealthy and who's not wealthy. It's that this guy became wealthy at your expense and now wants to cut the only programs that are working for you.
And I really hope
and the Obama people are actually doing a good job telling it right now.
Yeah, and I really hope that obviously this audience is keyed into it, but I hope that there is a wider understanding of two things about these Bain attacks. One is that those wise Democrats told Obama this is not the way to win the election. They didn't do it based upon any type of political savvy. They did it based upon who their allegiance are to. So
who
when Bill
want,
Clinton comes out and says,
they might go work for once they're done in politics.
Or already work for. I mean, when
right.
Bill Clinton says, don't attack Bain, that's not the right way to go, that's not what people want to hear. What Bill Clinton, the subtext of that is, these are my people. These Bain people are my people. And people
actually,
should understand that.
Harold
and
Ford
people
is actually working for them.
Indeed.
Now.
And
not Bain, but Merrill Lynch, I believe.
Yeah. And Bill Clinton is surrounded with these people. And he always was. And so I hope there's a greater understanding of this, that when people hear a Democrat giving ostensibly electoral advice, that they understand that it's not necessarily electoral advice. A and B, I hope there's also a wider understanding that if the Democrats certainly do know, I mean, the Obama campaign is showing that they know what the way to electoral success is, that anytime you hear a Democrat saying this is not what people want to hear, understand that they're wrong.
This is what I'll say from my perspective as a PR, whatever, however good or bad I am in PR or as having been a campaign operative. What the guys who were doing the campaigns for Kerry and Gore didn't seem to get, which is amazing to me, whatever, is life is told in stories, right? And that's why Hollywood Pictures do what they do, and that's why, you need to tell stories. And the story that you tell about your opposition needs to be one that ties – it can't just be he's got crappy policy A, B, and C that doesn't tie them into a grander narrative.
Right.
The overall narrative has to be one that ties their policies together and also ties their policies to a character attack. Let's be honest. Everybody
yep.
pretends you don't do that. You do that. It has to be about who they are. And the Bush one, this is what used to drive me freaking insane, was such an easy one with the daddy having been president, the pictures of him in a cheerleading outfit when he was at Andover that never made it into a campaign commercial, had me banging my head against the wall. The story about this rich, spoiled brat kid who had nothing better to do, he'd screwed up everything he'd ever run that had been handed to him, was such an easy story to tell and why he didn't get it, who you were and your particular struggles. And again, with Romney, the story of the economy right now and the type of economy we've morphed into and his role and how he got rich and who he is and his lack of understanding his social awkwardness, it's an overall story. And I will give the Obama people credit because in 2008, my critique of them was they did a phenomenal job of telling the story of who Obama was. But they were terrible in telling a negative story about McCain, which was sitting right there to be told, too. They shied away from it because he was a war hero. They didn't want to. And if the financial crash hadn't happened, that would have been a much closer election. I would give a slight advantage to Obama because of what Bush had done, but it would have been a close, very close election. And now, ironically, I think actually the opposite. I think the Obama people are doing a much better job telling the story of who Romney is and telling a story about themselves because a lot of the compromises and whatever. But the truth is right now is Obama's going to get hit so hard on this economy and be judged so hard on it that the more important story politically from Mattel is the one about Romney, which is I know you're going through tough times now. I know things suck, but this guy's just going to make it worse. You can't go to him. And that story is an easy one to tell, and they're doing it.
Yep.
And that would be what I would say looking at the whole thing.
Yeah, I mean, the Romney thing is a very classic case. I mean, because you can see it even in terms of reporters. The stories that get some traction are always ones that in some way say he is not like the rest of normal people. And it's either because he has Cayman Islands things or he doesn't know how to be gracious to people when they offer him a cookie because he thinks it's crap and he's only used to having, a private chef, develop his desserts for him or whatever, cook his desserts for him.
Doesn't thank the woman who opens up her restaurant and all tears
of
it
all
apart.
That's why these stories bubble to the top is because they tie into a broader narrative of who Mitt Romney is. That's how campaigns are covered. And it's not that, look, I'm sure you could go back and find the same story about every other candidate who's ever run for president ever, more or less. But the difference is these resonate because this is who Mitt Romney is. And the Obama campaign has done an amazing job of making sure this is the vision of him. And he's not going to recover come the fall. Cliff.
No, I don't. I mean, I just think it's going to get worse. And again, and the thing is, the brilliance of the narrative about him, again, it happens to be true, but also is that if the economy does keep having problems, again, he doesn't become the answer to those problems. He wanted to be the businessman that would come in and fix things because the economy was bad. That he was going to be the answer to your problems. And the Bain story, plus all the things he does to himself, the making the house bigger and the jet ski photos and the I like firing people and the I bet you $10,000, is he plays exactly into that because he can't help himself because that's who he is. Things may not be so good right now and they may not be recovering as quickly as we want to, like the jobs numbers say. But honestly, you're going to hand the reins over to that guy?
Well, the problem that Mitt Romney has is when he comes in and says he's going to fix the economy, people think that he's going to fix it so that his ilk continue to derive all the benefits from it. And right, that's
they will. And
indeed.
That's the story the Obama people are telling, which in this case doesn't just happen to be a good story. It happens to actually be true. So, I mean, in the end, I mean, the policies he's advocated for would do exactly that. I mean, he's talking about a tax cut of $250,000 a year for people making $1 million a year or more, much, much bigger than what George W. Bush came in and talked about in much worse times. It's ridiculous. So, I mean, in the end, it happens. The best story to tell always, I still think, not to say that you can't get away with telling untrue stories. George W. Bush certainly did, but telling a true story is always the best thing because you know what? Again, Romney plays into it again and again. The Obama people can almost sit back, put the campaign commercials on, have some surrogates go on the air and repeat certain talking points, and then just watch. As the guy climbs on his jet ski and hires his own personal lobbyist and insults the woman whose restaurant he goes to sit in. I mean, it's like a disaster. And yet, for you and me, it's utterly effing hysterical. I love every minute of it.
Cliff Schechter, thank you so much for joining us. We got to go. I got Jonathan Crone, the former conservative wonder kid, will come on and give me some movie recommendations.
Just say for me, say hi and word. That's all you need to say to Jonathan Crone for me.
Cliff, we'll talk to you soon.
Great story. Thanks a lot, Sam. I appreciate it, buddy.
Talk to you next week. Bye. All right, folks. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Jonathan Crone. We'll be right back after this. Here it is, the Republicans' health care plan for America. Don't get sick.
If you think that's a fair ad, okay, then you're a Republican and an asshole. Have at it, Hoss. Be in that party. Despicable, man.
They're the bad guys.
Endless taxpayer bailout.
Yeah, that's not true.
When Obama won, the reason why we worked so hard for him,
we didn't want a garden variety politician. Taking a stand, not just cutting deals.
That's what vision is. Yeah. That's what vision is.
The Best of the Left podcast. The best of the truly liberal media. Edited, organized, and mixed. Only at bestoftheleft.com.
We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report. You'll recall earlier in the week, I don't know if we played this in the better half of the program or not, but I replayed a clip that we did on Break Room Live back in the day. I think Marin was absent that day. God knows he slacked off a lot during that show, left me with the yeoman's work. And we talked about a 13-year-old kid, 14 maybe at the time, who had given a speech at CPAC, had become a darling of the conservative world, as you would expect. He was very articulate, and he had written a book, and he was given a speech, which I think I fairly critiqued at the time. And then earlier this week, a story, I think it was in Politico, saying that he had changed. And I'd like to welcome to the show Jonathan Crone. Welcome to the program, Jonathan.
I'm glad I could be here, Sam.
Let's start with this because you're going to give us some movie recommendations. But let's do a little housekeeping. First off, so I did that piece on Break Room Live, and then you tweeted, and when I was talking about it, I said maybe he watched the show. Did you really watch it? You tweeted me. You said you watched it at the time. You didn't watch it.
I did.
When
I
you
did.
Were a kid,
I did. I remember when I did the when I gave the speech, I looked at all the media stuff that there was a lot of stuff coming in.
Right.
And it was one of the YouTube videos that came up, I remember, around that time having to do with me, and I saw that video. I remember that.
I do remember that. Like, what did you think at the time? Because I don't think I knocked you personally. I think I was talking about
No, it wasn't as bad as some of the stuff I had said about me. I mean,
I bet.
Come on. It, I've had a lot worse said about me. I mean, and even worse now. I've had probably some of the worst stuff ever said about me after this. So
well, yes. I mean, nobody likes it when you renounce their positions. The people had really the conservative movement had really, at least at that time, invested quite a bit in you, hadn't they?
Well, yeah. I mean, I guess they had supported my books. They supported my my writing, I guess, and they'd supported me speaking. I just, you know, and I have a piece I'm finishing up for Salon right now, actually, about this, about my personal reflection here. And, you know, part of what I say in there is it's this mentality that a lot of people on the right have, that it's so awful that I decided to let myself take time to think about things and maybe just move on. I don't know why they're so upset that I matured. I believe the title I decided upon for the piece is Kid Matures, Conservatives Don't Understand Why This Happens. I don't know why they're so upset and still wondering why this happens. Actually, one of the best things, and I'm not the only one who's critiqued this, a few people, and I think the Young Turks, who actually I'm going to be on their show tonight, but they actually made a joke about this too. The Fox 5 did a big thing making fun of me about because of all this, and they went on there. One of the rips they gave me, and I didn't notice this because I was running out of the – I was in a green room when the show came on for the Fox 5 making fun of me because I had seen a tweet about it. And I didn't – so I didn't get a chance to watch most of it. But apparently after I left, the Fox 5 went on to say – and he quoted philosophy. Now, when you quote philosophy – that's just – you shouldn't be doing that. That's just not cool. It doesn't make you look good. And I'm like, wait, what? Am I not? Is that a bad thing? Apparently, having an education in philosophy, according to the right, according to the Fox 5, and talking about it is a bad thing. Apparently.
Well, I got to tell you, I mean, of the Fox 5 have to be the worst of the worst. I mean, it is.
But you know what's sad is that like they have people such as Dana Perino, who is an actual press secretary for a former president. And I just kind of hoped that she'd have a bit more class and say, that's not a nice thing to say about anybody at all. Just give them, and like Greg Gutfeld, who's the most unfunny attempt at a comedian in the history of mankind, he actually went on there and said he would have left me in the woods as a baby. And how is that funny? That is not funny, and they laughed. How? And then he said Crohn's. He said I have, quote, Crohn's disease. That is not funny. That is rude. That is mean to everybody who has Crohn's disease.
Well, I'll tell you, what you're learning, and you'll see this more, is that the notion that you have of adults and the supposed decorum and competence that they have, as you get older, you begin to realize that that is all just a mirage. And the Dana Perinos of the world are, we don't see this much in any public life, I think, much, some measure of decorum. I mean, it's there's a lot of people who go for a buck in that situation. Yes, but you're absolutely right about Greg Gutfeld. And I think
why did anybody give him his own show to be a comedian on? He's not funny.
I got to tell you, Jonathan, you realize that you, from a career perspective, you could have made so much money as that right-wing pundit. So much. I imagine you did okay with the book, but I'm saying, oh, dude, you have no idea what you gave up. Look at Greg Gutfeld. He's people actually think he's a comedian now.
I know. I mean, I don't get it. I really don't. It's kind of sad. But you know, to each his own, I guess. Everybody's entitled to have their own definition of humor, I guess. Just don't impose your own definition of humor on me.
There you go. Well, let me ask a question. So this is what also is sort of fascinating me. Now, you're heading to school. It's been reported you're going to NYU. We can talk about the potential of an internship at a later time, as we are based in New York. But how did it come about that Politico wrote a story about you? I mean, was this basically you saying like, oh, I'm going to college. Undoubtedly, people are going to, you know, my stuff is all over YouTube. I got to set the record straight I'm not going to have any friends there.
Yeah. I actually do make mention of that in the Salon piece. And what I say there is that the people who think that I'm doing this to get acceptance at school obviously don't know how the internet works, right? Once you have a video on YouTube, it's in the international, the world consciousness forever,
right?
It's not going away. And you think that just because I go and tell people I've changed my mind, the people in the world, and much less in a school environment, are going to just ignore an easily lambasted speech of a 13-year-old me with a nasally, high-pitched voice ranting about conservatism's four principles? Obviously, anybody who thinks that hasn't met the people that live on the internet.
Not going to give the whole show to people. Not going to do it. Not gonna. We're gonna cut it at the hour mark. Tease it. You get to listen to half of Jonathan Crump. Great guest.
He's good.
Matt's a little nervous. Get an intern in here. The guy's philosophy major. You think you can't work a board?
I see.
All right, folks.
Very funny.
You can become a member of the Majority Report by joining at majority.fm. We're going to head into the better half of the show. You can call me at 646-257-3920. If you're listening to this and you're wondering why we cut off Jonathan Crone, well, that's because all you get is that for today. You want the rest of that interview, you have to become a member.
But they wouldn't be listening to this.
Well, you're going to have to move this. I may have to do a little editing.
Got it.
Sorry. All right, I'll be right back after this.